latest upsurge of attacks. We'd like to hear about it. I'm at dennis@kpfa.org, dennis@kpfa.org. You can tell me anything else you're thinking as well in terms of the programming or what you might like to see us take a look at. We do appreciate broadcasting. It is a privilege to broadcast you over these privileged, free speech, no holds barred, truth to power, non-corporate radio airwaves. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Stay tuned.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to an archival KBOO radio show from the tape vaults. Times, dates, and events heard on this recording are no longer relevant or have already occurred in the past.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except when soft rains fall and drip from
me. Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Ramiza Shamoon Koya, author of the new novel, The Royal Abduls, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, in conversation with Joanna Rose, Portland-based writer and teacher and author of the award-winning novel, Little Miss Strange. Ramiza's fiction and nonfiction has appeared in publications such as Lumina, Washington Square Review, Catamaran, and Mother magazine, and she's been a fellow at both McDowell Colony and Blue Mountain Center. Ramiza has an MFA from Sarah Lawrence College and has lived and taught in Spain, the Czech Republic, and Morocco. Ramiza now lives here in Portland. In addition to the novel Little Miss Strange, which was an Oregon Book Award finalist and won the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association Fiction Prize, Joanna Rose's work has appeared in Zizova, Story Magazine, Artisan Journal, High Desert Journal, Oregon Humanities, Cream City Review, and Northern Lights. She teaches youth and adults around Portland for literary arts writers in the schools, the Portland Book Festival, and young musicians and artists. Her novel, A Small Crowd of Strangers, is forthcoming in fall 2020 from Forest Avenue Press. Jenny Forrester has this to say about The Royal Abduls: Koya has crafted a tender-hearted story with a sharp knife edge. She's cut to the heart of the devastating effects of colonialism and white supremacy on multi-generational American immigrant families. And, in the words of Carol Zoroff, The Royal Abduls is a novel for our times. It is a novel of struggle and a reminder of the hope that we once felt and that, hopefully, we will feel again soon. Let's join Ramiza and Joanna as they talk about the Royal Abduls.
So I want to start by reading a piece from an article that you wrote, a beautiful essay that you wrote in Mother Magazine in 2017. My main heritage is of hybridity. Fiji, Indian, Scottish, Native American, German, and more. I have an Arabic name, but I'm not religious. I have made my attempts, traveling to family homelands in Fiji and India, dressing myself in salwar kameez, and saying prayers with a scarf over my head, learning Arabic and studying Islamic art. I lived for 3 years in Morocco, but still, cultural affinity never led me to religious calling. So what I would like to start out by asking you is, when did you write this book? When did you start this book?
I started this book quite a long time ago, I think about 2005, and all those identity issues were there. At that point, I actually did leave the country for 4 years and lived 3 years in Morocco, and I had spent time in India before that a couple of times. So I had been exploring all of those things. I started the book then, but I did take a long pause when I had a baby. So when my daughter was born, probably for about 4 years, I didn't work on the book. And, you know, it bothered me a lot. I tried to do some other writing. I could do some editing, but I couldn't get back into that brain space. So I would guess in about 2000, maybe 14 or something, I asked friends who are potters who had some empty space, storage space above their pottery studio, if I could rent it as a writing space. And at that time, there was a character who died, and I felt that it was the wrong character. So I ripped the whole book apart, rewrote a huge amount of it, you know, really like took it, put it in all these different pieces, reorganized it. Rewrote everything that he needed to do in order to have a different character die.
I know, it's hard to kill off
characters. Yeah, it is. And I thought people would be pretty pissed by the character that was going to die, and this made more sense in a lot of different ways. So I probably finished that, I would say, you know, maybe 2016, and at that point started to look for a publisher or an agent.
Well, from 2005 to 2016, a lot of things changed.
Yeah.
Did the essential vision for the book change? Did the book itself evolve along that time?
No. I knew what I wanted Amina to be. That was very important to me. And the relationship between them, the way that it's written in the two perspectives, I never wanted to change. And I felt like the issues that I was writing about really stayed relevant.
So if you were to be asked the question, why did you write this book? You think there's an answer to that?
Yeah, very much so. I think I write because I want a voice, and I want people to hear my voice, and I want to be a part of the national conversation around the issues that I'm writing about. And, you know, I have a more maybe political kind of motivation maybe than some writers, but I'm also very devoted to story and plot. I think I'm a very traditional writer in that sense. I often feel humbled by reading other people's work that's more experimental, but I don't write like that. I write very based on character and story. And yeah, that never wavered. That was the structure, and I just kept it.
Well, I think, you know, on my first read of this book, I found it very hopeful, mm-hmm. Because the characters, they tried to give up on each other, and they never really could. They kept being drawn back to each other. On further reading, yeah, it feels more bleak. And I think that's because it fulfills the basic definition of dramatic irony. And this speaks to your storytelling skills. You're a really good storyteller. In dramatic irony, every problem gets solved, and that solution causes the next problem, mm-hmm. which is the next bigger problem. And your story just powers on that way. Were family stories a part of your upbringing?
Wow, no.
No.
No, not so much. I mean, a little bit, but... No, we're more of a secretive kind of family, and a family that doesn't talk about a lot of things. And so I think figuring out my own story is part of the reason why I'm a writer, because I kind of was handed a pretty complicated family from the get-go. My parents divorced when I was very young, and my father was a young man from the Fiji Islands and eventually moved back there. He died when I was 13. So I didn't have a strong relationship with my family from Fiji. I grew up with my mother and my stepfather and two half-siblings. I also have a stepmother and a half-brother in Ireland. So I had to make sense of all of that. And I'm now helping my daughter make sense of all of that. And I wasn't given a lot of guidance on how to do that. So I think that writing is one of the things that's helped me to do that.
Well, you know, in our writing group, we often refer to what we call as the autobiographical fallacy, where we caution each other not to assume a story is true to the author's life when we're writing fiction.
Yeah.
In this case, it sounds like it parallels your own life in many ways.
It doesn't, actually. I mean, I'm not a scientist. I did study anthropology, but for a couple of years in graduate school. But... no, I don't feel that it is autobiographical. I feel there are pieces of, you know, things from my life all throughout the book. I've had a pretty wide-ranging life, and so there are all different kinds of things in there. But I don't feel like her story is my story. I feel like it's pretty different. And I feel like, you know, I didn't have a relationship with a nephew like that or a job like that. I didn't definitely, you know... kind of do this, whatever she does in terms of her love life is very different from my my
disclaimer.
Yeah, and so yeah, I don't feel that it's autobiographical per se.
Well, so if but it does sound like a family that kept its secrets the way the Abduls keep their secrets. They don't connect on important things.
Yeah, they don't communicate well, for sure. And I think that's true, and that can be true in my family. The assimilation of the parents of Mo and Amina is very, you know, not something that I would say is reflected in my own family at all. But I do see, you know, the importance of his grandparents to Omar. My grandparents were important to me, mm-hmm. too. So I think some of that love is in there.
What about in your travels? You've traveled really widely. Did you seek out story as you traveled?
No, I didn't seek it out. I think it's just what you live and why I find it so stimulating and interesting. And I mean, it was just always a passion of mine from a very early age, like from a teenager. Even earlier, I mean, I think when I was maybe 13 or 14, my best friend and I, we grew up in rural Colorado, and, you know, we were like, we were going to graduate from high school and we're moving to New York City. And that didn't happen right away, but I eventually did that. And along the way, like, I had my first trip to the UK and met my half-brother for the first time when I was 16. Huh. And I was just like, you know, my first footstep into London, in spite of the open hostility of the of the border people, was soon as I got into London, I was just like, oh my God, you know, like I want this, I want all of this. And so I did a ton of travel from that point on. That was always my goal. One goal that I haven't achieved was to be on every continent, and I wish that I had, but
which
I haven't.
Which ones have you missed?
South America, Antarctica, and Australia.
Antarctica's a hard one to get to.
That's a little tougher.
You say when you first stepped into London, you were shocked by that open hostility. Was that... talk about your early experiences with that kind of
reaction. Well, I had plenty of experience with that
In rural Colorado.
Yeah. I mean, every time I stepped on the bus, I got called a name or told to take a bath or something. And my brother was physically bullied a lot. So that part I knew. I just hadn't really crossed a border that way and realized that they would see me as a threat, as somebody who was trying to move there. And, you know, they brought me to tears, and I was really shocked.
Well, I reached out to Mo Davio, who wrote about your book. She's the author of Every Anxious Wave, which is a novel. And she said, about your book, she said, the most masterful aspect of the Royal Abduls is its treatment of love. Love is hard in this book. And I asked Mo what she would ask you. And she said, she wonders about your own family and your experiences of prejudice after 9/11. And she points out that it's a singular and rarely told story, and that we don't hear many Indian Muslim stories.
Yeah. Yeah, that is something that was important to me. India is a multi-ethnic society in spite of what's going on there right now. And, you know, I think that's a voice that should be heard. I did experience some incidents after 9/11, and, you know, like one time I forgot my bag, you know, I checked my bag at a store, and when I went back to get it, the guy was freaking out, and he was like, I thought you were bombing us.
Was that here in Portland?
No, it was in California.
In California.
I think. And, you know, and
because you checked your bag, he thought you were bombing?
Yeah, because I forgot it.
Oh.
You know, just as you might, you know. So, like, little things like that, but also just a larger sense of, I think at the time I was in New York City for 9/11. You know, it was a terrifying experience. But also, like, I had kind of dreamed of moving up to Maine, and everything felt like it changed. Like, the next time we went up, there were American flags everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And it's sad, but as a brown person in America, the American flag can feel very hostile. It means America for us. And I just felt, I was like, I can't live here. And that is echoed in the book a little bit, where she's living in rural California, and she sees the flags go up, and she's like, I can't stay here. So things like that, for sure. You know, being told to go back where you came from and all that usual kind of stuff became more prevalent, although that had been throughout my life. People are very uncomfortable with my name and become uncomfortable when I say it and ask them to say it back, you know? And people always want to know what it is, and what kind of name is that? And if I say Arabic, you know, there's definitely a reaction. And I don't want to be like, well, it's Arabic, but I'm actually Indian, you know? Like,
yeah.
You don't want to excuse it, but I'm not from an Arab country, right? And I was born here. I mean, I'm a citizen. But, you know, some of those things did become more difficult, and I became more aware of them. And then some of those incidents that I knew from family or stories that I heard are definitely in the book.
Between 9/11 and the time of Obama's election, things seem to have changed.
Yeah.
You tell a really beautiful story about where you were the night of the election.
Yeah.
Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't where I actually was, but I had a very profound experience around that. I was living in Morocco. My daughter was newborn, and when she was born in April, the end of April, and so when November came around, I was up in the middle of the night, breastfeeding her, watching the election results come in, and I had kind of followed it, but I too, like, thought it was impossible that a man with a Muslim name would ever be the president of the United States. I literally thought it was impossible. And I knew that people from the U.S. were telling me, no, he's going to get elected. And I did not believe it at all. So I'm there in the middle of the night, you know, 3 a.m. or whatever it is, breastfeeding my daughter, who, you know, shares my middle name, Shamoon, which is an Arabic name. And I just started bawling. I mean, I just started crying and crying and crying. And I thought, this is a different world, the world I never dreamed was possible. And it profoundly affected me. And I was so, you know, it was so connected to just like, my daughter's going to live in this world.
And then how long after that did you come back to this country?
We came back when she was about 1.5, mm-hmm. So maybe a year later, yeah.
Was that part of your decision to come back? Did it make it easier to come back? Or?
Well, it's interesting because, yes and no. We left, when we left, Katrina had just happened. So like on the TV, literally as we're yes. flying out, or people on their roofs waving, crying, help me, help me. And everyone said, well, did you leave because of Bush? And that wasn't actually true. Of course, it helped. But I didn't feel, I just wanted to live abroad. That was one of my goals in life. And it was the right time for us. I had spent a semester teaching in Spain, and we were able to find work in Prague. And so we went, and that happened to be that moment. When Obama was elected, you know, yeah, that made me feel like, maybe this is going to be a more receptive country, a country that can see me and where my daughter can be comfortable. But it was also very much about kind of Moroccan child-rearing practices, as I've written about, like in my essay, Tolerance, you know, just very much not wanting to raise a child the way that they did and get the result that they did, which sounds terrible because Moroccans are wonderful, wonderful people. They just have different ideas of what it means to make a human, what kind of human you want to make. And there weren't going to be a lot of opportunities there for Ophelia. So, you know, we just thought maybe it's time to go back.
And how did you choose Portland?
Portland chose us. So we chose, well, it was bad timing. 2008 was the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. We had sent out our CVs to all the universities. We each had a few interviews. And then the financial crisis happened, and most of those froze, so their jobs no longer existed. Mm-hmm. They couldn't hire. I had one interview at NYU, and John had one interview at Lewis and Clark, and he got the job. And so we came to Portland, having never been here before, though, of course, we went to Morocco without ever having been there before, so it didn't seem that scary. It seemed like a nice place to live and a good place to raise a kid. And within, you know, just a few months, I was kind of sold. I was like, this is a lifestyle. I can manage. I can raise my kid here. Yeah.
Did you find the election of Barack Obama, how did that influence your story? Did it change your sense of how the story was going?
No. I mean, I really didn't think about it that much in that way. I think putting in that scene did happen very late. And that was because I wanted that kind of sense of hopefulness that you mentioned that apparently turned to unhopefulness. But, you know, I felt like that was kind of a hopeful moment and also an educative moment in terms of, you know, her talking to Dilpa's niece and, mm-hmm. you know, trying to explain some cultural differences there.
Well, I think that one of the strengths of this book is the consistency of the narrative voice. It's got a really beautiful narrative voice.
Thank you.
A kind of an overlay of human sensibility that goes from narrator to point of view character to point of view character. And it surprises me that it could be that consistent over such a long period of time of writing it, considering that the basic story itself didn't change for you. Over the years.
Yeah, I always felt like I could just sit down and be Omar's voice, or Amina's voice. I never felt difficulty in doing that, and I don't know why. You know, I'd never written a kid character that young. I had never...
Have you worked with kids that young?
Oh, yeah, and younger, sure, yeah.
Because my history with you started when I observed you in a creative writing class
yeah.
at Lincoln High School. And I know my own experience with working with youth is one of astonishment at how they tend to go right for the most dangerous things to write about. They go for the hardest stories,
yeah,
the jugular.
They do.
And when I observed you in your teaching, I was aware that you very much encouraged young people to tell their stories.
Yeah.
Talk about a little bit about how your work with youth has informed mm-hmm. your work with Omar or your own mm-hmm. writing.
Yeah, well, I mean, in With Omar, there is kind of a direct connection. When I lived in New York City, after I got my MFA, I was teaching at the State University of New York, Purchase College, which is an art school. And then I had also interned during my MFA at Teachers and Writers Collaborative. So after a couple of years, I decided I wanted to do that as well, that I missed it and I loved it. So I went to work for them, and that was pretty soon after, you know, like 2 or 3 years after 9/11. And I worked at a school with elementary school students. Mm. That's what I did there. I didn't do high school students like I did here. So there was a kid named Omar, and he clearly was being bullied. He had a broken arm. He had been pushed off a play structure. And so I kind of made him my project to sit with him, to write with him in Arabic, which I had studied in graduate school, and to help him be seen a little bit, because I had tremendous sympathy for him, and I knew that that was going on all over the city. And there's a little kind of scene like that where a mother pulls the kid away from Omar in the book. So there was that kind of direct connection. I don't know, you know, writing in that voice really kind of happened. Like, it started, the book started as the kind of the much shorter version of the first chapter. It was a short story called The Hybrid Zone. And I thought I would have a book of short stories called The Hybrid Zone and Other Stories. And I was sad when it became a novel, in part because I lost that title. And then, you know, it definitely, like, I didn't know it was going to be a novel. So I lucked out. I mean, just absolutely lucked out, and got 2 weeks at McDowell's Colony the first time I applied. And I had this beautiful studio called Wood Studio that was covered in bark, and it was way out in the woods. Mm. Some of the New York writers were too scared to walk out there. And I loved it, and I basically lived there. I slept there every night and got up at, you know, like 7 a.m., which is crazy for me. I'm a night owl, and wrote until 3 every day. And when I first sat down, I sat down at my desk, and I'm looking out this huge, gorgeous window at these beautiful woods. And I wrote, Omar was happy. And that's the beginning of the second chapter. And that's just what came out. I wasn't really expecting it. Yeah.
I love youth. I like working with youth. And I loved Omar.
Yeah.
And I found him to be so smart. He, all the adults in the story are ciphers. But Omar sees them so clearly.
Yeah.
He asks all the right questions. Unfortunately, nobody is answering the questions. Right. They're not listening to him. But every observation he makes is so astute. It's almost heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Why don't you read us a passage that you feel like reveals Omar a little bit?
Okay. In this scene, Omar is going over to dinner at his cricket coach's house. Now, his cricket coach, Prakash, turns out to be Amina's boyfriend. And he has been resentful of this, but he's kind of come back around to it. He thought maybe they broke up. Anyway, he's been invited to dinner at Prakash's house. And so he arrives. And he can see some evidence that something is going on with his aunt, but he's letting it go. So here we go. When Prakash arrived, shopping bags in hand, Omar's mouth literally fell open. Prakash had stopped wearing his turban. He's sick. He still had his beard, but his hair was short. He looked like a different person. You, he started and then stopped. Prakash laughed. My turban is gone. Yes, what do you think? I didn't recognize you. Prakash began unloading groceries. He was going to teach Omar to make samosas, and he had brought other snacks, spiced nuts, cucumbers, and cherry tomatoes and papadum to fry. Why did you do it? Omar asked. It was time, Prakash answered. He set out flour in a large bowl, started searching for something in Aunt Amina's bare cabinets. How did you know it was time? Omar persisted. Because I didn't know anymore why I was wearing it. Because when people asked me, I didn't like my own answers. Omar waited for more. Prakash tried again. Wearing a turban was about expressing the beliefs of my father and his father about their culture and their past. I respect those things, and I wanted to honor those traditions, but I didn't have my own reasons. Plus, people probably thought you were a terrorist, Omar offered. Yes, Prakash said, not pausing in his kneading. Probably some did. That sucks, Omar said. Language, Prakash admonished. They keep thinking that I am. I don't think that's quite true. Yes, Omar said, my classmates, it keeps happening, but I don't care anymore. Your parents are making the best choices they can, Omar. Prakash stopped kneading and covered the bowl with a dish towel before turning to wash his hands. Omar was proud that Prakash was talking to him about these things, and so he went ahead with another question. Have you ever seen the Al-Qaeda websites? What? Prakash turned quickly to look at him. Have you ever watched their videos, like on YouTube or anything? No, Prakash said, and I don't wish to. Have you? I didn't like it, Omar said, trying to reassure him, but they said some things. They say they want to make the world better for people like us. Prakash looked shocked. Omar, the world they want would not be better for you or for me or for anyone that we know. The world they want is unjust and violent. Please tell me you won't watch those videos again. But why do I get in trouble just for asking about it? Just for watching what they say? What's wrong with doing research on them? Omar's voice, against his will, sounded babyish. Prakash did not let him off the hook. I think you know, Omar. Those men are enemies. And if you choose to listen to their words, then our government will not like it. And now that you have had one problem, you cannot do it again. You cannot. Is that clear? Omar cast his eyes at the table. Omar, is that clear? I heard you. Omar slumped in his chair. Amina appeared and looked between them. Omar felt a moment of panic and sat up, thinking that Prakash was going to report him. I am letting the dough rest, Prakash said after a brief hesitation.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. On today's show, our guest is Ramiza Shamoon Koya, author of the new novel, The Royal Abduls, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, in conversation with Joanna Rose, Portland-based writer and teacher, and author of the award-winning novel, Little Miss Strange.
You know, I'm glad you chose that passage, because Prakash is the most honest with Omar. He's the one adult that speaks exactly what Omar needs to hear, and he tells him the truth.
Yeah.
He tells him the truth about why he took off his turban, and he tells him the truth about why he should not look at those videos.
Yes.
Because they're not good, and because he will get in trouble, and this is why. And he's the only adult that speaks straight to Omar, which is really tragic.
Yeah.
Because Omar is so bright, and he really wants to know. But then when Amina comes in, the conversation stops, and it's really too bad for Omar that it stopped right there.
It does, and it has repercussions. And, you know, I think a lot of the adults are trying to be protective, but also are very much in denial. You know, his mother and his father, you know, even Amina is still working through the kind of the same issues. They're working through them together, and she doesn't have a lot of clarity for him, and she doesn't know how to act or behave either. And so, you know, they have a wonderful relationship, and she's doing her best, but she doesn't know how to play that role either.
No, she's in a hybrid zone too.
That's right, yeah.
I think this idea of a hybrid zone is fascinating. It's an amazing metaphor for everything.
Yes.
And I had to go, it's such an intriguing piece of language, hybrid zone, that I had to go look it up. So I'm going to read the definition that I found.
Okay.
Amina is an evolutionary biologist, okay, which is also an amazing metaphor for that character. Hybrid zones are areas where the hybrid offspring of two divergent taxa are prevalent, and there is a decline in the genetic composition of populations from one species or taxon to another. And, of course, then I had to go look up Klein, which is a gradation of one or more characteristics in the different population of this species. So you studied anthropology for a while. How did you come up with the idea of a hybrid zone? And there are whole passages about her work in hybrid, in evolutionary biology.
Mm-hmm.
So did you know anything about the wild silk moth before you wrote this book?
No. I, in graduate school, studied cultural anthropology, and I had a roommate in this little tiny tenement apartment on the Lower East Side, and she was the one who was studying what's called, or sometimes called, physical anthropology, but bears a strong resemblance to evolutionary biology, which is where I took this. So I was me in all of my different ethnicities, and she was Bengali and Swedish, and she knew about hybrid zones, and so we called our apartment the hybrid zone. And I loved that very much. And she told me a little bit about it, and, you know, I don't know, the book was not even a star in the sky at that point. But when I started writing the story about Amina, the evolutionary biologist, I did want to write about hybrid zones. So in some ways, I had to find two plausible, kind of fake plausible field sites, one in the Sierras and one in India. And so I did a lot of research, and I learned about this guy named William Sweetner, and I read some of his work, and I became attached to the idea of the moss, which became also a big metaphor in the novel. And I really loved the idea that it wasn't sort of butterflies or some beautiful thing, that it was some ordinary thing that could do this extraordinary thing, which is interspecies mating, which is technically impossible, but it turns out is possible in certain conditions. And I think that the site in India was at that point largely imaginary. I just kind of, you know, put together something that seemed like it might be plausible, but, you know, there was only so much I could find that I could use. And I didn't want it to be, yeah, I wanted it to be like kind of a fairly obscure, like, little thing. So at that point, I was closer to when I had been in graduate school and reading very difficult texts, so I could do that kind of research and understand it better than I probably could right now.
Did you do a lot of research into hybrid zones and moths that didn't end up in the book?
Probably not. You know, I probably used as much as I could, because there was only so much that I was capable of sort of rewriting in a way that I felt other people could understand. And I remember that was something, one of the copy editors, a comment was kind of like, I don't understand all of this, you know? And I was like, well, I wanted to keep it in. I felt like it was okay that some of it was might be confusing or difficult for somebody to understand. I wanted to just keep it because it was important to me, and it was important to Amina, and because I found it fascinating.
Well, and it's just perfect for her place in the story and her place in the world, her place in academia as a woman, and her place in the family.
Yeah.
She encounters a lot of sexism. I think sexism is a big part of her struggle, both within her family and in her work.
Yes, for sure.
It's pretty much what gets her to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And the idea of Washington, D.C. as a setting, that's another hybrid zone. That's just
right.
An amazing hybrid zone.
That's right.
Well, and actually so is California, you know, and then there's, you know, the cricket field when they go watch a cricket game. There's another hybrid zone. And Prakash owns a bookstore. There's another hybrid zone. There's just layers and layers.
Yeah.
There's layers of it. And that's what got me to the word fractal. I thought, this is a fractal.
Yeah.
So a fractal is a never-ending pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And there are infinitely complex patterns that are self-similar across different scales. They just repeat and repeat through reoccurrence, a recurrence within the fractal itself. And they're images of, in physics, they're images of dynamic systems.
Yeah.
And it goes back to this idea of this story just, it's the same story for every one of these heartbreaking characters.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is a good metaphor for the way that the hybrid zones kind of repeat upon themselves. Yeah.
Well, what I especially love is that it's such a great metaphor for her experience of family. Her father is a really interesting character to me. He's a professor of English literature, and like old English literature, like Keats. He loves Keats. And her mother is a university wife.
Yeah.
And he returns to the idea of honoring his roots late in life. And so his struggle to define who he is and land in one place and then land in another is kind of what everybody in the family is essentially doing.
Yeah.
But Amina is probably struggling to do that the most and the least successfully.
Well, I think, you know, they have the grandparents, or Mo and Amina's parents, they're the immigrants, right? And they're Anglophiles, which is not, would not have been unusual for that generation. Lots of people would have been educated to be in love with Keats or Yeats or whatever, you know, and so they grew up in an Anglophone world in India, and coming to the U.S. as professors, or as for him as a professor, that felt very real to me, that's how they would be. They wouldn't want to be, just as, you know, my father didn't teach me Hindi, people didn't. They came over and they assimilated. And they wanted to badly, and within academia you could do that pretty successfully at the time. So I think that's kind of their story, but I really didn't want to tell an immigrant story. I wanted to tell a second generation story. And so Omar is born in America and is mixed race and is very much, you know, struggling with identity still, but just in a different way. And Amina and Mo as well, like, they aren't given guidance on how to be Indian Americans. And there are various points in the book, you know, where they mention, you know, kind of asking for more information or trying to get in touch with that and just not really being encouraged. And I think that's kind of classic. Some families do, and some cultures do, you know, very much insist on everybody sort of staying within the culture. But that's not always true. And I think for a lot of people in second generation, these issues do present themselves because outsiders are looking at you and saying, you're a foreigner. And you're like, no, you know, my parents were born here. I was born here. And what do you do with that? Mm-hmm. And that is a difficult experience.
Well, and it seems to have particularly affected Amina. She doesn't really seem to have a sense of rootedness, even when she... Like when she goes to D.C. and tries to reconnect with Mo and Marcy and Omar, she's just awkward at it. And yeah. Sometimes it's very funny. One of my favorite parts is when she, early on, when she goes over to dinner at their house and they're sitting at the table and they're, you know, trying to talk and not talking. And she says, this was what it meant to be part of a family, apparently. The unexpected onset of vaguely distasteful responsibility interspersed with nice home cooking. She felt pleased and disgruntled at the same time.
Yeah.
And she does. Every time they try to interact as a nuclear family, it goes sideways pretty fast.
Yeah, for sure. And I think for her, part of that comes that she doesn't want to be her mom. You know, she doesn't want to be this assimilated wife. That's very important to her. She wants her own career. She's very, very ambitious. And so she does have to kind of, you know, break away from her parents to do that. But also, she is awkward, and she is not an extrovert or a person who has tons of friends or likes to go out and party. She's a scientist and a geek, and, you know, that's her world. And does that make some things hard? Yeah. And she doesn't know how to interact with them. She knows that she wants to be closer to Mo. She knows that it's probably important to have family and be close to them, but she has no idea how to go about it.
Right. And part of that is the sexism that surrounds her. Part of it is that the experience of that particular family, but it's imbued with sexism everywhere she turns.
Yeah, I mean, the expectations upon her are not ones that she wants. She doesn't want to get married and have kids. She does leave her boyfriend in California because he's kind of saying, like, yeah, this is where this is going, and she says, no, I'm out. And that's part of her struggle with Prakash, whether or not she can be with somebody who is probably going to want those things. And, you know, she does appreciate family, I think. She just doesn't know how to do it. and she kind of gets sucked in by Omar and her heart and her love that you mentioned, you know, like she empathizes with him and she sees him and she doesn't know what to do, but she recognizes that somebody's got to do something. Mm-hmm. And so she does step in and start to fill a much larger role than she was expecting.
So I see her as really strong and independent. And I got the feeling that she didn't see herself that way. Mm. That she sees herself, she questions herself constantly.
She does. I mean, she makes fun of herself. She's very sarcastic. I do feel like she has a strong sense of what she wants to do and career. And I think that is very underwritten. And I also feel like, you know, the sexism that is a part of that is very underwritten. And so, you know, encountering, you know, working in an office where you're the only woman, the billions of women can testify, you know, like that's a very difficult situation. And she is not somebody who is flirty or engaging in anything, but is always seen as a sexual being and encounters a huge amount of sexism all mm-hmm. around her. And I think that's a pretty normal experience.
I feel like Omar is the only one who really sees Amina for what she is, for the strong, amazing person that she is.
Yeah, he thinks she's amazing.
Yeah.
He thinks she's just the coolest. She does research, which is his, like, weird thing that he loves, and she knows stuff. He fantasizes that she knows a lot more about India than she does, but he finds whatever she does know and brings it out in her so that they end up trying to learn about India together. And he doesn't really, I don't know if he fully understands how little she actually knows, but she pulls it off, you know, and they do it together.
They do. And some of the funniest scenes are in the book are about those attempts of the two of them trying to do Indian stuff, especially around food.
Yes.
The scenes around food are some of the funniest scenes in the book.
Yeah, because she really can't cook.
No. And the restaurant scenes are just awkward and also made me hungry. Yeah. You do a good job of writing about food.
I love food, so that was easy.
Was it?
Yeah.
Why don't you read us a passage that you feel like shows us Amina?
Okay, great. So in this scene, something big has happened a little bit earlier, which is that Omar brought a decorative Indian knife to school and had it out and was expelled. Amina was in charge of him that weekend and kind of took care of it, but she doesn't really know what happened. She's arranged to go to the Museum of Natural History with Marcy and Omar, but Marcy gets a work call, and so she ends up taking him around on her own. So they start walking. It's real crowded, and she sees that there is an exhibition of Islamic artifacts, and she just decides to go for it. Suddenly determined, Amina led him over to the case. They stared in somber silence at the case of engraved swords and ruby-encrusted hilts, at the animal-featured handles and silver-threaded velvet scabbards. Amina's hair fell forward against her cheek, and she let it stay, shading her face. "What happened to your knife?" she asked, trying to sound indifferent. "The police took it," he said. "I can get you another one," Amina offered. He shook his head. "I'm not supposed to have knives now." Amina looked around and saw a bench in the next room. She led him in, and they sat amid walls carpeted in red and amber textiles. "What happened that day, Omar?" "It was an accident," his lower lip puffed out in defiance. "I won't tell your parents anything. I just want to hear your side." Omar shook his head, but a single tear slid down his cheek. "Did the boy say something to upset you?" The dark head shook again, but this time it seemed more of a wag. "What happened then?" Omar drew his lip in and bit it, tears running free down his face now. "I hate him. I hate him. I hate him." She reached into her pocket for a tissue and gave it to him. "Who?" "Davy Madsen." Omar pressed the tissue to his throat as if stopping a wound. "He said we were nothing. He said I wasn't even Indian because Indians were Hinduists and that I was a liar and their family wasn't special. He said that Muslims will all die when the U.S. has a chance. And then I showed him the knife and said I would kill him first. He sobbed and hiccuped, and snot ran down onto his upper lip. "Okay, it's okay." She put an arm around him, and he leaned his hot face into her shoulder. Then he lifted his head and looked at her. "I wanted to do it. I wanted to kill him with a knife. I would have." She tried not to let the shock show on her face. She took out another tissue and tried to wipe his face clean. "You wouldn't have, Omar," she told him. "Are you listening to me? You wouldn't have. Just because you wanted to doesn't mean that you would have done it." He started to cry all over again. She searched her mind for words that could soothe the hunger in his heart and the fear in hers. She understood his ache for reassurance that their family, history, the world made sense. But all she could think to tell him was that he should find a way to escape into an inner world to fiercely guard his solitude. Because there were no guarantees, and there were always people who were disappointing and cruel, and you could go your whole life searching but never find a place where you belonged. But she couldn't say that, not to an 11-year-old. "How about some dino fries?" she said. "We'll get ice cream, too." He nodded his head, reining in his sobs. "Chocolate sauce?" "Extra hot fudge and sprinkles, too," she said. "And whipped cream!" His face broke into a radiant smile, the smile of a child again. They left the carpeted room and followed the red signs to the exit. In the corridor, pandemonium continued unabated. She took his hand to guide him through a class of kindergartners, but even after they had passed through the pack, she still kept a hold on his sweaty, soft paw. They descended the stairs together, past skeletons and models and squares of printed text, endless charts of the unfathomable past, none of which pointed the route to a rational future. When they reached the cafeteria, he shook his hand loose, running ahead to locate the ice cream. She pushed back her hair with a sigh, feeling their separation like a pain. She poured herself a cup of black coffee and took it on a tray to where he stood in front of a vast array of confections, conjured for the multitudes who visited this hallowed hall of science day after day, and she ordered him his sweet.
See, there's that fractal thing happening again. They're just, you know, struggling to connect and doing all the right things, and it's kind of not working for them.
Yeah.
And as is always the way with youth, we kind of hope it'll sink in at some point. Talk about your decision to choose these two point of view characters.
Mm. You know, Amina was somebody that I really, really wanted to write a difficult, ambitious, career-driven character who wasn't motivated by traditional, you know, woman things. I've got an essay coming out called Driving Home that's a little bit about gender and my kind of history with that took me a long time to kind of fully explore. And I think when I first started writing short stories, I almost always wrote from a man's point of view. And the reason was I felt like a man could do anything. And if you wrote a woman character, you had to write about sexism and oppression and things that they couldn't do. And I really, at some point, wanted to turn that around, and I started trying to find the voice of a really fierce woman. And to me, Amina, confused as she is still somebody who is really fighting the good fight and is uncompromising, and that's what I wanted to write.
Well, it's true. She always knows what she wants. She wants to study bugs. She wants to go to hybrid zones. But she's kind of her own hybrid zone, the way she keeps having to fight off society's expectations, and she's not sure quite how to do that. There are only a couple places in the book where she's absolutely out front with people.
Yeah. Well, it's a hard thing to do.
As a woman,
you know, you've got everybody arrayed against you, and people want very, you know, with all good intentions. They, you know, people believe that you must have children. People believe that you must be married. People believe that it's not okay to be a single woman or a woman who's focused on just her career. And very few women do overcome that. It's a lot of societal and individual pressure, not to mention things like love, you know, that get in the way of that. Mm-hmm. And so she's constantly struggling with it. And, you know, it's hard to disappoint your mother. It's hard to disappoint, your boyfriend.
Yeah.
And so, like, all of those things, they're shaky for her. And she's still quite young, you know, in the book. And she's not fully figured out her life. I mean, she's in the process of it.
Mm-hmm. Did you have those kinds of experiences in academia?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you weren't in the sciences. Do you think it's harsher in the sciences than in the humanities?
Well, I worked in the social sciences, so probably, yes. I did have really bad experiences, and I didn't feel like I was welcome or that I belonged, and I dropped out of graduate school.
Well, I know I've heard some of your wilder travel stories, too, and some of the stories I've heard have alluded to those same kinds of interactions.
Yeah, terrible sexism and racism all over the world. That is without a doubt some of the, obviously, the worst, not, I don't know why I said obviously, some of the worst sexism certainly happened to me in India.
Mm.
Yeah, where I had some very dangerous experiences and was lucky to make it out relatively unharmed.
Uh-huh.
The place where I was most welcomed and seen was Morocco, where everyone assumed I was Moroccan. So I was very comfortable, and that's the one place I've ever been where people saw me as just them. And that was a remarkable experience.
Although that wouldn't have lasted because there would have been expectations on you as a woman and a mother.
Yeah, and I think that was a kind of a turning point, you know, as I described before. It wasn't just me, it was, you know, other people, like, why are you doing that with your baby? Why is your baby out of the house? They don't take the baby out of the house for, like, a year, you know, the baby's always swaddled, like, that kind of stuff. And so my woman who came in to help out around the house and help us feed each other while we were both working and having the baby, you know, would just come in and be like, what are you doing? Why is she sitting up? Why is she doing this? You know, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff was really hard. I felt very isolated by that. So, yeah, that was a turning point.
So you came back and you came to Portland. In what way is Portland a hybrid zone?
I guess I wish it was a hybrid zone. I don't know that I think that it is. I feel like it is a more homogenous place than I've ever lived. And that part I don't necessarily like. I do like the lifestyle here, but I don't find it particularly complicated in that way.
So you think that the aspect of Portland that we tend to call the bubble, this little liberal bubble,
yeah,
is a factor of it not being a hybrid zone?
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
So will your daughter read this book? Has she read this book?
She's read the book and identified all of the typos immediately in the ARC in like the first day she had it, yeah.
What did she have to say about the book? She's 10?
She's 11
she's
now,
11.
Just like Omar, which is just a coincidence. Weird one. You know, I started writing the book before she was born.
Yeah.
So, no, she's a fan. You know, she tells everybody it's really good. I think she's very proud. She loves to read and write and always has and is always constantly starting books and not finishing them. But I think that's a good sign. I hope she, well, I think we have a little bit of a lineage. Of, you know, my mom wrote too, and I write, and I think she's going to write as well. And I'm sure that that's, I'm sorry, because she's going to make, you know, 5 cents a year. But you know,
yeah.
Like, it's also great. It's great to see that she's passionate about that and that she is proud of me.
Well, what else would you tell us about this? As kind of a wrap-up, what would you want to say?
Oh, my. I hope that people read it and talk about it and that it's becomes part of a conversation. And I've been so moved by how the literary community here has embraced it and supported it. And, you know, I don't think I've ever understood gratitude more. And that's the Portland book community, and I'm so honored to be a part of it and to have that support and to have this experience with my publisher, Laura Stanfill, who has done amazing things with the book and is always, always advocating for it. And those things have been really moving to me, and really, it's been an incredible experience.
Well, I have to say that working with an independent press is another level of the fractal.
Yeah.
Right?
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Joanna.
Thank you, Ramisa.
You've been listening to Ramisa Shamoon Koya, author of the new novel The Royal Abduls from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, in conversation with Joanna Rose, Portland-based writer and teacher and author of the award-winning novel Little Miss Strange. You can join Ramisa for the official book launch of The Royal Abduls at Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland on Sunday, March 15 at 2 p.m., and you're all invited to the after party at Literary Arts, located at 925 Southwest Washington, just a few blocks south of Powell's. I'm Ken Jones.
Listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.